John Fain. On radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
Would you pat a hedgehog with ungloved hands? No, you wouldn't. And that was basically the sort of thing that it was thought was the equivalent of trying to deal with some of the early pettifoggers, as they were called, the early lawyers in the colonies of Van Diemen's Land, Victoria and New South Wales. Wonderful journalism here. To punish a sharking pettifogger for malpractices by bringing him and his evil deeds under the notice of the court would, I fear, be something like striking a hedgehog with unarmed hands. That was what was written about some of the early rip-off artists who were practising as lawyers in colonial times. That's our theme for today, and we'll be talking to an academic lawyer who's written a book about pettifoggers, Simon Smith from Monash University. And our guests first up, though, have got hold of the very earliest diaries and records of the first resident judge in Port Phillip, a man by the name of Walpole Willis. So what do we learn about the early days of Victoria and, in particular, Melbourne and Port Phillip? That's coming up with our guests Janine Rossetti and Richard Broome from La Trobe University coming up soon. My co-host for the journey, well, who better than the ABC's own resident legal expert? Damien Carrick is the presenter of The Law Report on Radio National, 5.30 on Tuesdays, repeated 5.30 in the morning on Wednesdays. Damien, good morning to you.
G'day, John. How are you?
And thank you for bringing this information all to us. But there's some extraordinary legal cases underway at the moment around the world, including one on an issue that is very close to people's hearts here, which is the euthanasia debate. What's happening?
Yes, voluntary euthanasia. There's a bloke called Frank van den Bleeken. He's a convicted murderer.
In
Belgium, and he's a convicted sex offender, and Belgium have voluntary euthanasia. Now, the great bulk of people who go for this voluntary euthanasia are people who have terminal illnesses and are in terrible pain. But under Belgian law, they also have the ability to get voluntary euthanasia for people who have mental anguish. And he has successfully applied for euthanasia on this basis, saying, I still have violent impulses, I'm a tortured soul, I'll never get out of jail, I've been there for 30 years.
How old is he?
He's 50, I think. Yes, 50 years.
So he wants to just basically say, I've had enough, I want to check out.
That's right.
And the court said yes.
Well, it's not necessarily a court. He got the permission for the doctors, and then there's something called the Euthanasia Commission, the Belgian Euthanasia Commission, who kind of have sort of a role overseeing this. And I think that the corrections people also had a role here, because there were issues about whether or not this was sort of a capital punishment by stealth.
Well, that's what it is. They don't have the death penalty, but he's electing for it.
He's electing for it. That's right. And any day now, apparently, the final permission came through, the final hurdle came through earlier this week. So any day now, he will be transported from his prison in the town of Bruges in Flanders, northern Belgium, and he'll be taken to a hospital where he'll have a lethal injection.
Does he get to choose his method of death?
No, I don't think so. As I understand it, in Belgium, it's lethal injection.
So it's an injection. So this raises, do you look at it as a moral issue? Do you look at it as a legal issue? Do you look at it as a medical issue? Do you look at it and say, hang on, you can't let this become the norm? Or do you turn around the other way and say, well, if people who are not suffering from depression and have a rational reason for wanting to check out, if they want to check out, who should stop them?
I think there are two issues. I think there's those issues, which you're talking about, and then there are issues quite distinct to prisoners. On that first score, the Belgians seem pretty comfortable with this idea of people checking out if they have unbearable mental anguish. There's a very interesting case, Mark and Eddie Verbessem, 45-year-old twins last year, born deaf, live together, they're shoe repairers, they live together, they're socially reliant on each other, but they're identical twins, right? And then they get diagnosed with this disease that they're both going to go blind, a congenital disease, they're both going to go blind, right? And so they apply to, they say, this will be terrible for us, we'll be isolated, we won't be able to communicate with anybody, not with each other. And they are not dying, they are not suffering from a terminal illness, but they get permission to have this voluntary euthanasia. And
because they don't want to live without sight.
Because they say that living without sight will put them in unbearable, perpetual mental anguish.
Wow.
And that happened. And it happened, I think it was last year, it might have been the end of 2012 or the beginning of 2013. The other big case...
So they applied for,
yes,
got permission,
yes,
and then did carry out,
yes,
their own euthanasia.
Yes. Well, no, they went to a hospital.
Yeah, but they were allowed to die.
They were allowed to do this, yes, yes. One other quick case for you, also fascinating.
No, keep them coming. This is my head spinning.
Nathan Verhelst, 44 years old, transgender person, born a woman, became a man. The operations were not successful. There was sort of rejection of whatever was done to his... So he regarded himself as a monster, said he was in an unbearable psychiatric or psychological pain. Again, the psychiatrist said, yep, you are in perpetual anguish, and he ended his life as well. So they're the kind of issues which are really extraordinary as they pertain to some of the issues as they pertain to the kind of general population. Then when it comes to prisoners, there are also some very interesting issues. Oh, incidentally, you asked before about, you know, what happens to courts get involved. I remember reading at one point that there was a guy who was really angry because, again, of course, most of these people are suffering physical terminal illnesses. But there was one man who was really angry because his mum passed away, got voluntary euthanasia. She was suffering from depression and he was never told about it. And he was really angry. And I think he kind of tried to take this up with authorities. But the authorities were, no, this is about personal autonomy. And there was held to have been no misconduct or bad process in that woman's case. But of course, you know, some people, of course, recover from, most people, thank God, recover from depression. So,
do you say this is never going to change or might you regret it?
Yes.
But what I'm just trying to think through, if someone is, for instance, sentenced to prison, never to be released for horrific crimes, and there are in this country a number of people who are in that category, is there a moral wrong in saying to them, you are going to die in custody, would you rather opt for euthanasia? And if they want to, what do you do then?
I think that's a very, very good question, John.
Because some people in custody, they try to take their own lives.
Yep.
And then it's treated as someone, despite being in prison for horrific crimes, never to be released.
Yes.
We revive them.
Yes, yes.
If we get them in time.
I think the question is that when you take away somebody's freedom, you sentence them to prison, does that you're also taking away part of the freedom you're taking away, an argument could be made, is that you're taking away the freedom for them to check out at their point in time of choosing.
So you're taking away...
Their options
entirely in life. You must live until you die of illness or natural causes, whatever else it might be.
Then it becomes this very, very interesting issue. Is somebody sick or is somebody evil? Are they being punished? Are they being warehoused? These are complicated
issues. All of the above.
All of the above. And I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a criminologist, so I don't know how you.
And then we have, of course, every time you talk about these issues or capital punishment, you have the miscarriage of justice arguments, which is sometimes and on startlingly too many occasions, most recently in the ACT with the man who was released after it was found after decades in custody for allegedly murdering the police commissioner up there.
That's right.
The Winchester case. He's been given his liberty.
Yep. Yep. One final thing. The Belgians earlier this year, they changed their law to allow euthanasia for physical illness, not for psychological or psychiatric anguish, but for physical illness to children. So you can now be...
Sorry, run that past me again.
Okay, children who are suffering from a terminal illness, right, who are in terrible pain and suffering from a terminal illness, can apply now for euthanasia. There have been no cases
since... children can.
Yeah, yeah. And what it is the way...
starting at what age are we thought that they can actually form a sensible intent?
Yep. There's no age in the legislation, but they think that you will have to actually... Yes, of course, you'll have to show an understanding of what's going on around you. So they think it'll probably be around the age of 12 when it comes to practice. And there will be a lot more checks and balances. You'll need to have the child say yes. You'll need to have the parents say yes. You'll need to have the doctors say yes, the treating doctors, and you'll need to have psychiatrists say yes as well. These are very... This is a minefield. It's very hard to get your head around this stuff. But the argument was that there are some children who are in incredible pain, who are dying, and what is the best thing to do by those people? And
wow, because seem to have some. There are many attempts now, state by state or territory by territory, to try and introduce voluntary euthanasia laws for the terminally ill under various precautions and safeguards. Every time it's happened, it's been undone.
Yep.
And the activists and those who are, they say, determined, will simply keep trying. And sooner or later, I suppose, at some stage, it may be that public opinion swings sufficiently behind it for governments to say, well, like the medicinal marijuana debate that we've just been having, well, maybe this is something that was once regarded as absolutely no way that's now regarded as well, maybe, and then becomes a well, yes. Mm. And we're seeing medicinal marijuana is a really good example.
And you do see societies change quite dramatically. I think what's really interesting about somewhere like Europe is that you do have like 20 or 30 countries all in together, and you can actually just kind of raise your head above the parapet and see what's happening in your neighbour's country. And that can lead to, I think, faster social change than somewhere like Australia, where, okay, we have our federation, but we're all pretty much of the one mindset. And we kind of think quite in pretty much the same way in Northern Territory down to Tasmania. But I think in Europe and maybe in other parts of the world, you do. You see how people do things differently.
You've given me an idea.
Change. What's that?
I actually think it's about time we rethought the idea of the Commonwealth of Australia.
Oh.
And in fact, it's not just the West Australians that should secede. I think we should disband the Commonwealth and stand as separate individual nations.
Oh, well,
we can all go our own, like Scotland.
No, I don't think it's a good idea.
All go our own way.
I think we'd all be little minnows.
The fragmentation of many conglomerates around the world should come here too, and we should all stand alone.
John, I'll throw something back at you. Maybe why don't we go the other way and abolish the states? I think that might be a more practical thing for a little country of 23 million people.
I'm not sure which one's the least likely, Damien. Damien Carrick from the Law Report on Radio National, my co-host. I'm John Fain, and our first two guests today on the Conversation Hour are going to tell you about the absolute lunatic firebrand nutbag who was our first judge here in the colony of Port Phillip. Richard Broom is an emeritus professor of history from La Trobe University, and Janine Rossetti is a postgraduate student at La Trobe, and they've been looking at the casebooks of the first judge in Port Phillip. It gives you a snapshot of what it was like just when this place was getting started. Janine, Richard, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. What have you found, Janine?
Well, I've found that perhaps, while he was certainly controversial, that perhaps he was not quite the rat bag that you have just described him
Don't
as.
Don't spoil my story.
But I have found that he is a fascinating character whose career took him Upper Canada, British Guiana, Sydney and Melbourne.
Got struck off in Canada, fought with everybody.
Fought with everybody, exactly. But he was also acknowledged by even his worst enemies as a very intelligent man. He was extremely ambitious. He certainly had a strong sense of English, if not British justice. But it must be admitted that, yes, he did fight with everybody.
He was a bit of a whacker. Like, I read that he wouldn't let somebody appear in his court because he wore a moustache.
And he quite proper too.
He was also obsessed by that idea of separating the legal profession from the dirty hands of business. There was one man who he wouldn't allow to appear because he was a barrister who rented out a stallion. Were his big things... I mean, was he interested in really big issues, or was he just interested in kind of legal form? Legal substance or legal form?
He certainly was very well on top of all of the big questions, big legal questions, but he did become very hung up on small details. With the two examples that you've spoken about, which have been repeated many times when people are talking about Judge Willis, and let's face it, it is a good story, this first judge who made so many controversial statements, and people at the time said that going to the going to the court was as good as going to the play. And you had newspapers that didn't have much else to fill their columns because there was no town council at the time. All of the politics that was happening up in Sydney. You had a paper coming out every day that needed to fill all of these column inches. And so going down to the court made good copy. And certainly with the examples that you've got, I don't even know if perhaps there was a bit of very arcane judicial humour going on there. I think it must be a very rarefied thing. But when you look at what he was saying, say with Cunningham, with the Stallion, and it was a mistake that he was making anyway because it was actually his brother who was advertising the Stallion. But he then went on to say, well, you may as well talk about the ass at Heidelberg, and he lived at Heidelberg and he was referring to himself. So there was a little bit of a joke going on there, and the rest of the joke sort of got dropped off. Likewise, with the person who appeared with the moustache, and he started quoting some poem about a whiskered hussar or something like that. So it's all caught up in this very theatrical performance, and because it was a performance, I think he was very well aware that people were watching him in the court and that he was the talk of the town. But all of those stories have really dominated the approach to him.
So, Richard, what does it tell us about the early days of colonial Melbourne?
Well, reading through his case books, which Janine described to me this morning as like his lecture notes, because they're not always easy to follow and read. They're sort of a bit disjointed and things are crossed out. But you can get a sense of Port Phillip society, which was very rambunctious at that time. It was a rough and tumble frontier society. One of the cases that I looked at recently on the case books was a man tried for manslaughter. He got off, but it was some youths that come from a hurling match with their shillelaghs had attacked this guy who was singing. I think he was English by his name. They were Irish, and there'd been a bit of a fight and a biffo. He'd disarmed one of them with his shillelagh and then knocked him with it, and he unfortunately died. So it was a society that had a lot of splits and rifts, sectarian rifts. It was a society with a very dangerous frontier in 1841-42. So I think it can give you an insight into the way Port Phillip was operating.
I thought it was really interesting, the cases involving Indigenous people. There were some really, really interesting ones. The Bon Bon case, maybe?
Yep.
That's great. So yeah.
What happened?
Well, Willis, I think, was disagreeing in that case with the established view that had occurred in 1836 that when there was an inter-say crime, that is, between Aboriginal people, that they were still under British law. They were British subjects, and the governor had actually proclaimed this as well. But Willis disagreed. And it was the case of Bon John who was involved with the death of another Aboriginal man.
And what the argument was whether you used traditional law and let them punish tribal punishment, let that prevail, or whether the English colonial law should apply.
That's correct. And he even had some testimony from a couple of the Aboriginal protectors that they had seen judicial action within Aboriginal society over wrongs done, and there would be spearings of people. So he was hearing this, and then he decided that in fact British jurisdiction didn't apply, but of course that was against the prevailing view. But actually the case was decided not on that, but on the issue of some technical issues about evidence.
And also that opinion that he passed was just an opinion. Mm. He made this statement as he came into the court. It was a very long statement, so before things had really got underway, he started reading this lengthy statement where he was talking about the fact that the Aboriginal people were there first, that we were the invaders, that they had their own law. And he read it the whole way through, and he then said, I'm going to leave this for other people to decide.
Well, he came from Canada, which of course had a completely different legal relationship between the colonials, the colonial power, and the Indigenous people in Canada. And they have treaties, they have a completely different arrangement. Maybe he was bringing a bit of that learning to here.
I don't think so, or I have no evidence that he did that. Most of the
evidence, really, Janine.
I know. I mean,
for goodness.
Shame on us historians for wanting
he was
evidence.
Only actually in Canada for a very short period of time, only for 9 months, before he was dismissed Upper Canada.
Enough time to see there's a different way of doing things, the Canadian
True.
Way.
Yes, but most of his trials were in York, Toronto, and I'm not aware that any trials of that sort came up before him at that time.
There wouldn't be anyone more powerful in the colony, really, other than the governor. The only judge would be the next most powerful person, surely.
Mm. And that's the thing that I think that sometimes we can forget when we're having all of these stories about moustaches and stallions and many, many other stories that you could tell, that he was the only judge in Port Phillip and that he sat on all of the Supreme Court cases, he sat on all of the Quarter Sessions cases, he certainly kept an eye on what was going on with the magistrates. And it's easy to laugh at a distance, but he held people's futures in his hands.
And the other thing is, when he arrived, they were ecstatic with excitement because they wanted to be free of Sydney tyranny.
Mm.
And so they saw his arrival as a wonderful event. But then this sort of slow disillusionment, or perhaps fast disillusionment, emerged. But the public was still split. Even when he was thrown out, as Janine has found, there were petitions of equal size for and against him.
In fact, there were more petitions in his favour than there were against him. The difference was who signed the petitions. And certainly, as far as the people who were against him, you had the governor, the executive council, you had Superintendent Latrobe, you had the Chief Justice and all the judges, you had the Attorney General, you had the public prosecutor, the bar, every public officer except two or three, 18 magistrates, all legislative council candidates, and some other people, highly respectable people, as they said it. All against him, whereas for him, Latrobe went through all of the people who had signed the petitions in his favour, and many of them were merchants and shopkeepers and publicans and people of bad repute.
Why do you think that was? Why did the quote-unquote ordinary people seem to like him?
Certainly, at the time that he was dismissed, there was a financial depression going on there, and there had been...
Property crash, yeah?
Yeah, property crash. And because of the financial immaturity of Port Phillip, you had people signing notes or bills of exchange for each other, and it was a whole financial system that really just collapsed when the depression hit. And a lot of people got caught up in that, and so... certainly people, small people, felt that he was going after people who had acted improperly. John Faulkner was very much on his side and supported him through his newspaper. And so he was felt to be a friend of the little people, even though I really don't know that that was really the case.
What happened to him?
What happened to him? He... after he was dismissed, he hopped on a boat straight away and went back to London, which is where you had to go to challenge any dismissal. It took 3 years before it came up before the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, who was a small group. He didn't actually appear before them. He would just put in the documentation and be represented by counsel. And they decided, and this is the same judgment that was made in Upper Canada, that the dismissal was legal and it was warranted, but they didn't say what the reasons were.
So did he work in England? What did he
do? No, he tried very hard to get another position. He asked, well, in fact, they overturned his dismissal but withdrew his... ability to act as a judge. They gave him 3 years back pay because they said that he hadn't been given a chance to defend himself, but they didn't.
Sorry, so he lost but he won.
Yes, he lost but he won.
He lost his commission as a judge,
That's
got
right.
3 years pay for not being a judge and
That's
doing
right.
nothing, and then
yes.
what did he do?
He appears once or twice as a witness in a couple of royal commission or commissions before Parliament. He wrote a book that sank like a stone in 1850. And by then his wife had inherited her father's property, and so he moved to Worcestershire and lived in Worcestershire, was involved in local county politics, and died in 1877.
I read that somebody described him as having a functional derangement of the liver. Was he an alcoholic?
No, I don't think he was an alcoholic, no, but he did fall ill when he was in British Guiana, and that was used as a very convenient way to get rid of him. The governor in British Guiana was also asking to have him removed, but the colonial office wouldn't remove him, and so when he got sick, with great speed, he was popped on a boat and sent home.
Well, that's a pattern, because I've also found it fascinating that he arrives in Sydney and Governor Gipps, maybe, he's hard work. He's fighting, this new arrival's fighting with everybody. Mm. So he handballs him. He ships him off to Victoria. So yes. The Victorians are thinking, fantastic, we've got this great new judge. Mm-hmm. And the people in Sydney are throwing, whoosh,
yep, thank goodness we got rid of him.
Well, certainly the other judges were thinking that, yes.
The Royal Historical Society of Victoria is launching, and it's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court who's doing so, Marilyn Warren, the diaries, the casebooks of Judge Walpole Willis. Now, this is going to be on the web. So the Chief Justice launches the upload? Does she unveil
presses a button, and then it's revealed on the screen.
At the Royal Historical Society, about which you'll hear some more in a moment, is up in a Beckett Street, up near the market, opposite the Flagstaff Gardens. And Richard Broome, Emeritus Professor at La Trobe University, and Janine Rossetti, postgraduate student at La Trobe, have been trawling through the casebooks, the early casebooks of Port Phillip's first resident judge, Judge Walpole Willis, which provides you with an invaluable record of early Port Phillip. If you're interested in going along, get in touch with the Royal Historical Society. It should be an absolute hoot. There is a blog, if you want to have a look yourself, residentjudge.wordpress.com. If you want to have a look, residentjudge.wordpress.com. If you want to have a look at more. Simon Smith, who also has been researching the early years of Australia's legal history, joins us as our next guest as well, with Richard Broome, Janine Rossetti and Damien Carrick here on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Simon Smith is an old colleague of mine. In fact, if I go back far enough, he taught me. That's how old he is, when I was a student at Victoria's second oldest legal centre, Springvale Legal Service, where he was the teacher. He's written yet another book in a succession of books on legal history, this one following on from one about vexatious litigants that was published a few years ago, is about the pettifoggers, barristers and solicitors, that were some of the nutbags that populated the early days of Australia's courts. Simon has an obsession with lawyers who get into trouble. Morning to you, Simon.
Good morning, John.
Vexatious litigants, that's one group of people who get into trouble in the courts, people who are thought to be so troublesome they're not allowed to sue anymore. But that's this one, right, is about judges and lawyers in particular who get struck off.
Well, it was quite a natural thing to do. I mean, to give equal time to the other side of the profession. Vexatious litigants get sort of banned from going to the courts without further permission. So I thought, well, why not look at the lawyers who also get banned from going to the courts? And so that required me to go and look at the early admission rolls to see how many lawyers had in fact been struck off. And I discovered that there were many more than vexatious litigants. So until about 2009, there'd been 15 people declared vexatious in Victoria. But since 1841, there's been over 200 lawyers who have been struck off. So they win by a hefty margin.
And typically for what sorts of offences?
Well, traditionally, it's knocking off the trust account. Most people dabble in the trust account to pay the private school fees and to pay for the lease on the Lamborghini. And when the financial times get a bit difficult, they dabble in the money. And when that's discovered, they get struck off. And they also get a jail sentence, usually.
Well, in fact, it's regarded very seriously.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And these days, I mean, almost guaranteed to go to jail if you dabble in trust account fraud.
That's right. I mean, the record is about $8.9 million by Betty Bryant in 1976, and they move very swiftly. Although, importantly, we should point out that if money is stolen from clients, it is always paid back, and it is paid back with interest by the profession.
By the fund. Interesting sidebar here, because this is not what your book's about, but you mention it in passing, that you're not allowed even 40 years later to access the records about the aforementioned Betty Bryant and her massive world record trust account fraud.
It's a bit disappointing. I was looking to write that story up because it did lead to significant change in the law, and it also impacted legal aid because a lot of the money that comes out of the interest on the trust funds goes to legal aid. And in 1976, when the $8.9 million sort of disappeared, that created a big problem for legal aid. So I thought, well, it's time to write this story up. And I tried to get access to the original files from the Office of the Public Prosecutor, the DPP, and they declined to give me access.
40 years on,
which I was quite surprised. And I had permission from the family as well. The Bryant family were very cooperative.
She's dead. Most of the participants.
Betty Bryant passed away a few years ago.
The lawyers involved are all dead. All the people who made the decisions are all dead.
Similarly, the Law Institute, they have the original files because they were involved in paying the money back. But they also effectively declined to give me access, which was a bit disappointing. So I decided, well, I'd focus on the early colonial lawyers struck off, and they turned out to be fabulous yarns.
They are great yarns. Really, really good. Can you tell us about the crazy cat, James Erskine Murray? He is a whacker. And what I find is really interesting is that he's not just a lawyer, he's many other things. He's an adventurer.
He's absolutely an adventurer. He's an aristocrat. He's the third son of the Lord Elibank, a Scottish lord, and which is the Scots are in the news at the moment. But if you're the third son of a lord in the days of primogeniture, you realise that there's not much future for you. So what do? You go to the colonies to try and make a fortune. But before he did that, he was a ramble and a walker. He walked through the Pyrenees and wrote a book about it in the early days of travel. He also gave articles to Charles Dickens. He was a colleague of Charles Dickens, and so he could write. He came here. He was only in Melbourne for about 15 months, but was involved in setting up clubs and in the early horse racing meetings at the then new Flemington. But he too fell into dispute with Judge Willis and got struck off. So even as he was being struck off because he got into debt because of the land depression, he'd already arranged to become another adventurer. He'd bought a sailing ship, so he disappeared down to Western Port, got onto his own ship, his boat, sailed off to Borneo with a view to becoming a Raj there.
In the 1840s?
In the 1841, 42. So he gets to Borneo, mistimed again because he sought to conquer a little bit of an area and set himself up as a Raj, but the locals weren't having it, and so they killed him.
The local Bugis people,
I think.
That's
right.
He sailed up the river and he went too far up to make a quick escape.
That's right. He had three ships, and they were a very warlike people, apparently, and they weren't going to be conquered by anybody. And so he had to try and fight his way back down the river, and he got a spear in the heart, and he was buried at sea. And he was only really young, about 36, so it was a tragedy, really. The other part of the story, which I find interesting there, is that the word came back to his widow in Melbourne quite late because it had to come by ship, and so she sailed back to England. And one of their children found, and this is the very interesting nature of historical research, one of their children married a doctor in Scotland, in Edinburgh, who went on to become quite famous. He was Dr. Bell, and he had a very good friend called Conan Doyle, who wrote a book called Sherlock Holmes. And so Dr. Bell is the model for Sherlock Holmes. So it's quite a crazy
thing. So there's a direct link between
Melbourne,
colonial Melbourne, and Sherlock Holmes,
which I think is extraordinary. And the beauty of that was, of course, I found that through the internet, and that in the College of Surgeons in Edinburgh, where the papers of Dr. Bell are, I discovered parts of a journal from Isabella Erskine Murray, the wife, which describes early Melbourne in 1841. And it's just fabulous. It ranks up there with Georgiana McCrae's Journals of Melbourne. And if I could find the whole journal, it would be terrific.
Mm. And the great thing was that they didn't actually let you... They wouldn't kind of fax you or send you copies, but you got your daughter to go into the library. She was in the UK.
That's right.
And she just took out her iPhone or whatever she had, clicked, and then sent it to you.
The strange nature of sort of historical research, you can find where these things are, but the College of Surgeons in Edinburgh is not really an archive. They just happen to have these papers, and they wouldn't digitise it, and they wouldn't fax it to me. And so it just so happened that I had a daughter studying in Leeds at the time, and she became my research assistant. I sent her up there. She got out her camera. She took the images of it. Within minutes, I had the material here in Melbourne.
And that goes to the importance of having these sorts of resources up on the net, as you've done, Janine, and through the Royal Society, the Royal Historical Society. It's great to have that access.
Oh, it's fabulous. I mean, this whole book would not really have been possible 10 years ago, because the big breakthrough, I think, has been the National Library of Australia have had a project called Trove, like Treasure Trove, where they've been digitising the newspapers of the nation. And so you can now, for free, go into this website, Trove, at the National Library, put in your own family name, if you like, and you can search the old colonial newspapers of the nation and find every reference. And so, and not only can you do that in Australia, you can now do that around the world, and you find all these fabulous stories, and a narrative develops quite quickly. You could never have done that going into the State Library in the old days, getting the microfilm, putting it on the machine and sort of scrolling through it, because you get seasick after about 15 minutes.
But it used to be it was a mark of disgrace to be able to trace your ancestry to convicts, and now, through that wonderful, quirky turnaround that is so typically Australian, it's in fact now regarded as a badge of honour.
Well, you're quite
to
right.
To be able to trace your ancestry to convicts.
And that, in a sense, it also shows up how they were concerned about it in the early days. One of the people I profiled, John William Thurlow, his father-in-law was a convict who came out to Van Diemen's Land, and they're clearly very embarrassed about that. When they moved to Melbourne and one of the children died, the newspaper report or the death notice sort of said, oh, he was a grandson of Mr. Hodgson, who had been a major in the in a particular army squadron, etc. So it was absolutely airbrushing of history. He had been a convict who'd built the roads in Van Diemen's Land, but when they put the death notices in the paper for a grandson 20 years later, 25 years later, he'd suddenly become in an army regiment and a distinguished soldier.
Completely different. But it was interesting to see that some of the first advocates appearing in the fledgling courts in the colony were convicts.
Yes, yes. In fact, there wasn't really a free convict in Australia until about 1825. The convicts were in Australia until, and that's about sort of 40 or so years after Arthur Phillip came through Sydney, they were all convicts, and they all had to practice in the courts because there was no one else to do it to assist the courts. And they were quite speculative, and they were quite avaricious. But when the Supreme Court was absolutely established in Sydney in 1823-24, they were banned from practicing, and the court actually had to close down for about 18 months because there was no real admitted free lawyer to appear. So it took then from about 1825. Then the free lawyers began to arrive,
and for people like judges who were wanting to make a career in the empire, that made New South Wales certainly not a particularly desirable place to be sent.
Well,
for
it
example,
wasn't
judge,
anyway, was it?
No, but as a judge as well. After Judge Willis was removed from Upper Canada, he was writing to the colonial office very often, trying to get another placement. And he said, I'm willing to go anywhere as Chief Justice, except the coast of Africa, the East or West Indies, or New South Wales. And it's quite interesting that of the next two placements that he got, one was to the West Indies and one was to New South Wales.
And I can't remember in whose writings I read it, but there was one quote saying, my uncle is going from the land of the slaves, the West Indies, to the land of the convicts.
That's right.
And
yes,
to them, they were pretty much all the same. They were the ends of the earth, and they were full of, you know, not so good people.
And that's right. And what that also demonstrates is the patronage that was involved in getting a judicial appointment in the colonies. You didn't get one unless you had friends in high places. And Sidney Stephen, who you're referring to there, who came to Sydney as a barrister, following his father, because his father, John Stephen, had been appointed a judge of the New South Wales Court, both their appointments were made by one of their relatives, James Stephen, who was the most powerful person in the colonial office. And he was the one who said, well, you're swapping the land of slaves, because they were coming out of the West Indies, going to Sydney for the land of convicts. Mm.
But of course, it's true that if you wanted to become a judge, you had a much better chance if you were prepared to leave England and then had the patronage networks to allow you to find a suitable preferment there.
What I found really interesting was this idea that there were this globalised group of people, kind of elites, who were kind of spending time in Canada, spending time in the West Indies, spending time here, then running off to Malaysia and Hong Kong. That they were people who really were running an enormous empire and bouncing from one place to another.
Well, historians have focused on this probably in the last 10 years. They've looked at the interconnections between the colonial world and the way people moved around to get better preferments or whatever. And so it
Nothing's
was
changed.
Just interconnected. No, that's
Some
right.
Some diplomatic postings are all exactly the same now. But when I was reading through both the case notes of Willis and also, Simon, your book, Barristers and Solicitors, Pettifoggers, Profiles in Australian Colonial Legal History, when I was looking through it, made me think that you know, we talk about the legal profession being a club now. It must have been an insufferably tiny club then. Everybody knew everybody else's business backwards, and they were only a handful of people dealing with each other all the time.
Absolutely. They were all connected, very small, very small. But they also travelled around. I mean, I was struck with how much they travelled around the various colonies of Australia in those days. If they didn't work in Sydney, they'd go to Van Diemen's Land, then they'd come to Melbourne. And in part of that, I have concern for the families, because they took their wives and their children all over the country and all around the world. Like Sidney Stephen, he trained in London at the bar. He went to West Indies. They went to Sydney. Then they went to Van Diemen's Land. Then they went back to Sydney. Then they came back to Melbourne. Then he ended up, after he was struck in Van Diemen's Land, he was given a compensatory position as a Supreme Court judge in Otago in New Zealand, and ended up as the acting Chief Justice of New Zealand.
All by sailing ship, which would have been perilously dangerous.
Absolutely.
Journeys every time.
Mm. Exhausting, and having to do it every time.
So, Richard, as we learn more and more of our own history, and we've been very slow to appreciate some of it, does it change your view of what life in colonial Melbourne was like?
By looking at the case books.
Yeah, and hearing the stories and just more and more little pieces of the puzzle falling into place.
I think it enriches it. I mean, the colonial newspapers are wonderful, and really the case books need to be read with them, because you don't get the full story in Judge Willis's lecture notes in the sense. So you have to read all these sources together. But it certainly added to our understanding. And, of course, Janine's work shows just how central Willis was to understanding that society, because he was such a powerful man and everyone talked about him for several years.
And, of course, what Justice Paul Mullaly has done with these case books is the real benefit or the real treasure in this website, because he has taken the case books and bringing his knowledge as a judge and doing the research by looking at the newspapers at the time and also the depositions and the other documents in the Public Records Office, he has written a commentary about each case as well. And for me, as a non-lawyer, that's where the real strength is. So you're not only getting Judge Willis's notes that he was taking during the case, but you're also getting Paul Mullaly's commentary, and it's just invaluable.
Well, his work is just wonderful. He spent 10 years doing this pretty much.
No. He's actually hearing cases. He's a judge.
No, he's retired now.
Oh.
And so he spent a long time.
Was there an overlap? Was he doing this while he was still sitting?
No, I think it was something he decided to do when he retired. What
was
should
it?
I do? And he started to look into the history of the legal profession.
Wasn't while he was hearing some of those really boring cases.
I don't think so.
Say, you just keep talking and I'll just make some notes here as I work on my history project.
There's even a name index of all the people that appear in the court in Willis's time on that website. So for genealogists, you can Google or go and look at 2,000 names in the name index. So he's done a wonderful job.
See if your ancestor popped up in the court.
That's correct.
And look, whatever it was.
Just shows you what volunteers do for the Royal Historical Society of Victoria and all the historical societies from here up to the Mallee and to Gippsland. There's dedicated people giving time to protecting the records, to making them more available. A lot of local historical societies do digitisation as well, make them available. And it's a fantastic volunteer effort, which must be worth millions and millions each year.
Judge Paul Mullaly's annotations and the original casebook of Judge Walpole Willis is now online. historyvictoria.org.au/Willis. Simon Smith's book, looking at early lawyers who got into trouble and got struck off, as well as more legal history, is called Barristers, Solicitors, Pettifoggers, which is a great title and I think should be part of the modern, in fact, legal parlance as well. And you should, in fact, if ever you're introduced to someone who's a lawyer, say, are you a barrister or a solicitor or a pettifogger, Damien?
It's my word of the week. It's
I reckon so. And Simon Smith, thank you and congratulations. And Damien Carrick from Radio National's Law Report has been my co-host. Damien, Janine, Richard and Simon, thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.